Hello, and welcome to Crit Club, the podcast where four friends watch a movie on the Criterion streaming service that none of them have seen before and then discuss it. This week, I am your host. I am Corey, and I am joined, as always, with Angela.
Oh, hello.
Wizard.
It's me, or is it?
And Peter.
I wonder who I will be.
Are you Peter?
Time will tell.
All right. So this week, I chose to watch Inland Empire, the last theatrically released film by acclaimed musician, painter, author, and occasionally TV and movie writer and director David Lynch. It was filmed in 2006 in Los Angeles and Poland, notably both locations not in the Inland Empire. The movie stars really a who's who of Lynchian regulars, including Laura Dern, Justin Theroux, Harry Dean Stanton, Grace Zabriskie. It tells the story of, it stars Laura Dern. After the production of the movie, David Lynch did receive a Golden Lion Award at the Venice Film Festival. The movie received a upscaling to 4K with AI in 2022 because he made the odd choice of deciding to do it all in digital video, which gives it a very sort of distinct look. That's the version that we watched as it was released on the Criterion Collection. It's number 1175. So, my question to my co-hosts, did you get lost in the dream of Inland Empire, or was it a nightmare that you couldn't wait to wake up from? Angela. Actually, I also want to pose a second question, too. I would love to know what everyone's relationship with David Lynch is, if that relationship does exist. So let me know what your relationship with David Lynch is, and what did you think of this particular entry into his oeuvre? Angela, I would like you to get us started.
Jesus Christ. David Lynch is like, everybody likes David Lynch. There's a huge mystique to David Lynch. I like The Elephant Man. I like Dune. Those are my David Lynch moments. I actually really love Mulholland Drive. That one was like a major mindfuck. And at the end of it, though, I felt like I came away with something. Inland Empire is kind of a sister movie to Mulholland Drive for a few reasons. However, the question being answered here is, what did I think and maybe how I liked it? And I would just say that I watch films and love cinema because I consider cinema to be like an approximation of real life, right? I want to see echoes of humanity in cinema, and I didn't get that at all in I don't know what the heck I was watching. I would say the closest thing I could come to it would be he dwells instead in a place of creating an approximation of death, and that none of it all makes sense, and perhaps it's because death itself doesn't make any sense. So that, you know, that's pretty much the nicest thing I can say about it. I was bored a huge amount of time. I did, for the first time ever, I don't take notes most of the time, but I did hit a level in this film that was quite intellectual, and to the point where I was like, I will not be able to explain this verbally with my mouth unless I write shit down, because it just was so complex. And I'm also not of a mind to particularly share that stuff, because it's intellectual. It's uber intellectual. It's the most intellectual stuff, that reactions I've ever had to cinema. But I don't feel like this is the venue necessarily to talk about some of those things. And some of them are even like spiritual and weird and shit.
This isn't the place to talk about movies.
Yeah.
Well, it is, but it's just all the weird. I'm so exhausted by the state of the world and exhausted by watching this movie that connecting all of the dots and making them sound like a cogent, like intelligent human being is too much of a struggle.
Might I suggest maybe a bulletin board and a bunch of red thread?
It could help. It could help. It worked for Arrested Development. But I didn't hate it. I wasn't offended by this movie. I was really intrigued, actually. The number one feelings I had was like curiosity. Like it was like a big puzzle. I was trying to figure out what is the perspective that this film is taking so that I can glean some real meaning from it. Because it says a lot to me that Laura Dern was a producer on this film and a major actress, and I believe she was nominated for an Academy Award for it. I might be wrong. I have to double check. I'm terrible at looking at Google. But the stuff that her character goes through is really a lot and gut-wrenching and exhausting, and I want to know what the pitch was for her, like, to be in this movie. And we even see, like her as an actress, playing an actress in the movie, being pitched to or, you know, trying to accept a role in a movie. So there's layer upon layer upon layer, and there are too many layers, and it's hard to extract them all, and you need string and cards and a bulletin board to do it.
Very good. Thank you, Angela. I will say that Laura Dern was not nominated for an Academy Award for this.
Okay.
David Lynch did a very large campaign to push for her to get nominated, including campaigning with a live cow and sitting in a folding chair on the side of like Hollywood Boulevard or something like that. I remember seeing that at the time.
Nominate Laura Dern.
I remember seeing it at the time and just thinking, oh, man, David Lynch. All right. So, Wizard, what did you think? What is your sort of history with David Lynch, and what did you think of Inland Empire?
I do want to take a moment to acknowledge Peter's excellent David Lynch impression.
Yeah, that was good.
Which has deepened my relationship to Lynch.
I thought you were doing Bucky, the film grip in the movie.
My favorite FBI character from Twin Peaks.
You should be yelling more.
I'm trying not to clip the microphone.
Right. Wizard, what did you think? And what is your history with David Lynch?
You know, I like David Lynch, like, I think most of the time. I've seen all of his movies. I oddly have only seen, like, maybe half a season of Twin Peaks.
I would have figured you would have been, yeah, kind of on
I
the
took
regular...
a. Yeah, no, I took a crack at it during the pandemic, and, you know, I started it, and I just could not dig in, and this has got to be the third time that I've tried to dig into Twin Peaks, and it just hasn't taken. One day.
Interesting.
My favorite David Lynch film is Wild at Heart.
Oh, yeah.
Which is
a little less...
It's like, it's still weird, but it's like a little more grounded than some of the work that he, like Mulholland Drive or this movie, or some of the other stuff that I've seen him done. I like David Lynch. I think he's cool. I think he's like a fun, strange dude. I enjoy his work. Did I enjoy this piece of work?
It's the question.
It's an interesting use of words, too. It is a piece of work. it's, you know, I don't know if I liked this movie, but I didn't dislike it either. It is so, like, it seems so intensely personal, so dreamlike, so, like, untethered from anything at all. Which I think is interesting. I think that's kind of the point, is that it's this like puzzle that Lynch puts in front of you, and you kind of watch it and fiddle around with it and try to build connections and try to gain a grip on the movie, which I'm sure does have like makes something like sense. I don't know. Laura Dern is super awesome. It was a real delight watching her like embody all these different roles and really like go through the ringer. Like, she looks terrible in the back half of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's so long, and like, I love a long movie, but the middle
especially
of the movie,
when you add in the 75 minutes of deleted scenes that are also on the Criterion.
Oh gosh,
channel.
A quarter of serious.
Yeah, I started watching it.
A quarter of the movie is in Polish, which, like, I am, again, down to see a foreign film, down to watch subtitles, down to do all of that. But everything just all together, this movie is so extra, and I respect it for that. And at the same time, I don't know that I had a great time watching it, which is weird because we were talking about our picks not long ago, and I was like, oh, I really enjoy like an unstructured movie. Like, I really like something that like that plays with like making movies, and this does all of those things. And there are parts of it I really liked, and there are parts of it, long parts of it, where I almost never look at my phone, but I looked at my phone at least once. Yeah, I'm interested to hear what everybody thought about it and what do we make of this? Because I think there's a lot to mine there. I liked this movie, but I'm not sure why.
How about you, Peter?
I feel like I can pinpoint every single sort of like moment or node of my history with David Lynch, because I feel like we've had years together. Because I don't know, it's very interesting because I distinctly have these memories of seeing the beginning of Blue Velvet when I was maybe 10 or 11 or something. Like, I remember what's his name?
Kyle MacLachlan.
Dennis Hopper?
Kyle MacLachlan finding the ear in the field.
Yeah,
I have this, like, I still remember what that looks like in my head and as a child, like, seeing that. And then I think when I was 15 or 16 and I was starting to be cool and into movies, I watched Lost Highway, which had just come out. And I really did not enjoy my time with that. I was like 15 or 16 or whatever. And I actually haven't watched it since then.
I remember going to the theater with a group of friends to watch that. Was that... I don't know if you were part of that or not.
No, I wasn't. No, I remember watching it at my parents' house. I was so like, ugh, David Lynch is so stupid, just like weird for weird's sake and all this blah, 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 blah. And then I remember in like 19 or 18 or 19, I watched Wild at Heart, and I really remember having a great time with that. And then I think something a little soon after that, I watched Blue Velvet, and I was like, oh, okay, this is an incredibly good movie. And then I finally got around to watching Twin Peaks in my late 20s, and that's one of my top five TV shows of all time. I deeply, deeply am connected with Twin Peaks and love it in so many ways. And then the time, I think Mulholland Drive is a masterpiece. And so, like, David Lynch and I have just grown further and further together, and I have an utmost respect for him as an artist. What I thought of Inland Empire is still waiting to be deciphered, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, my view, like, I think it's actually really fun to talk about, like, or to hear about how other people's viewing of this movie, because I thought I was being smart, and I was like, I'm going to try to break this movie up and watch it in maybe, like, hour chunks or hour and a half long chunks or something to try to make it, like, digestible, because it seems like a big weight to throw on yourself. But I turned it on and I didn't stop because I was in it. I was like, okay, I'm, you know, as soon as rabbits showed up, as soon as fursonas tread the boards, as soon as, I was like, all right. And I was just like really hooked. And I don't think I was bored for, maybe there's a tiny bit of lag, I guess, in the scenes in Poland towards the end where it got really windy and twisty and very nonsensical.
The movie just gets very dark I don't know.
Yeah, I still don't know exactly what I'm thinking about it. Like, I'm a little dreading, like, giving this a score later on because I honestly have no idea. Like, I think I really respected, and I'm really glad I watched it. I think I both really respect this movie as something that's going to work in my brain for a long time. I think negatively or critically, it felt a little bit too much hammering on themes that he had been driving. Like, this really, like, Angela, I'm really glad you said that this felt like a sister film to Mulholland Drive, because it really felt in a lot of ways a sort of mirror image of it, and sometimes treading the exact same themes as that with a lot of the same people sometimes, which made it a little bit like I'm not sure how I feel it, because maybe there's like an oeuvre that he's talking about, his own meta work of art, but how much of that is, I don't know. Laura Dern was great. I was constantly captivated throughout most of it. And even when the movie's heavily Polish, I'm still like, why is that guy having a noose and those guys have bowling ball pins right up until there's the lumberjack sawing wood at the last dance number.
Sawing wood in time to Nina Simone. Wow.
Like, I think there's something I'm sorry, I'm talking, I'm rambling. I do think that there's an interpretation of this movie that is very much a meditation on an actor's life inhabiting a role, mm-hmm. but also about how that's what we're doing as people every day, mm-hmm. but also that's how we reflect on each other, the stories that we tell and understand, and how those worlds that we make up in our own mind get twisted and turned, and then it turns into the whole tesseract of other people's narratives about mm-hmm. ourselves getting twisted and turned. Mm-hmm. There's like some beautiful, you know, thing. There's some beautiful interpretation that I think I really loved about this movie. I'm not sure it stuck that landing wholly, but I think most of it is there, and I think I enjoyed most of it. All right, I'm done. Okay. Corey, what the hell do you think?
I think, like you, Peter, I've had a sort of lifelong, you know, partnership with David Lynch. He's just sort of always been a part of my life. He's always been a part of my, you know, psyche. I discovered him also at a very young age and stuff, and I distinctly remember like renting Dune at like, you know, 12 or 13 from the local library and stuff and watching it.
That's a great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And after watching this now, I've now seen all of his movies. In college, we had Twin Peaks Club, where we would watch an episode like every week or every couple days or something like that with like a group of friends. And there were like six or seven of us. And we were watching it. And then I just remember like during that time, like that we were watching Twin Peaks, anytime we would go to like another party, like on campus, it would just be the six or seven of us huddled in a corner just talking about Twin Peaks. Like we weren't even at the party. We were just like talking to each other about stuff. And I've watched Twin Peaks a couple other times. My wife is very much a fan of David Lynch, of Twin Peaks in general. It's one of those sort of comfort TV shows for her. It's just kind of like often on in the background and stuff around here. And I think that watching it with her, with Frida, it made this movie like even more fun. I think this whole movie really does kind of play like a greatest hits of David Lynch, just as far as like his actors, but also just like the cinematography and like the themes and the sort of, you know, this is him at his like sort of most like unhinged and dreamlike and all that,
saturated.
Yeah. And so it was fun to watch it with, you know, someone who really likes all that stuff. And
had Frida seen it before? Frida
hadn't seen it. She had never seen it either.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, you know, the actual, you know, watching of it was just like, I'm of two minds. It's like there is part of it where it's like, yeah, I want to like figure it out and I want to like read up on it and see if there is stuff to piece together. But then there's also, you know, parts of it where it's just like, it is a dream and you're just kind of like, let the dream happen to you. And maybe you'll remember some of it. Maybe you'll forget some of it. I actually watched it twice.
Yeah. I was tempted to.
And it makes more sense the second time. Strangely, just in that there are like faces and things and scenes that you see at the beginning of the film that you're like, oh, that's that person who come, you know, an hour or two will pass before that person, you know, comes back and all that stuff. Right. So I think it's also kind of interesting that, you know, David Lynch works with longtime partners, not just in the acting, but also with his music composers. I'm going to butcher his name because I didn't look it up here, but Angelo Badalamenti. Yeah.
Who did not work on this.
This is mostly like David Lynch's music. David Lynch. Really,
his tunes are banging. You hear him sing on this movie a couple of times. I was like, oh,
this one
shit
goes out to you, Laura.
Right. But also, interestingly, his longtime partner with editing, Mary Sweeney, who also wrote A Straight Story, which I watched last week, didn't edit this one either. So, like, I heard it this talked about as, like, he didn't really even want to give it to her because it didn't even have, like, a full script. He was kind of writing it as he went, and it was giving people, like, scripts and stuff, like, on the day of them doing it. And so it was very much like this thing that he held in his own head and stuff. And so he did a lot of his own editing and, you know, I don't typically like movies like that. I like my movies to have like thought and structure and all that stuff. But then, I don't know. At one point, I turned to Frida and said, you know, if this wasn't a David Lynch movie, would you still really like this? And she was like, I can't remember her verbatim response, but it was kind of like, no, probably not. and like, I kind of wonder about that, too. So it's like, how much of this is watching a David Lynch greatest hits kind of, you know, thing versus how much did I actually enjoy like watching the actual movie itself. I do think there is some bit of a coherent, you know, plot. Some of the themes that you were talking about, Peter, there is some of those things there, but I don't know. I will say, and just to get us to like sort of in the larger discussion about talking about the movie, starting at the very beginning, banger credits. Like, this is what I was talking about with like movies having credits. Get a little bit of that David Lynch spotlight, big letters, Inland Empire, bam, we're in the movie.
You're in it.
We're in it. Yeah. So after that, we really just start vibing. And I think that this whole movie is just kind of a vibe.
It's a vibe.
Yeah. So yeah, we open with this, you know, strange scene with like blurred faces and this guy with this prostitute. I don't know. Do we even want to like go sequentially through this?
What?
Yes, all 3 hours.
What even like, see, this is the trouble with, this is why this movie will be hard to score, perhaps. This is why it's hard to talk about. Like, this is four people discussing a dream that David Lynch had. Did it mean anything? Did it not mean anything? Like, all of these questions. It's not to say these questions, like, discussion isn't fruitful or worthwhile. It's just like there's an initial challenge, like a hump, I think, to get over where you're like, how do you explain Inland Empire to someone who hasn't seen it?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So, like, we get the scene with the sex worker and a tiny little bit of Polish dialogue, and then there are the rabbits. Mm-hmm. And then there are the three people, the three anamorphic rabbits. My question to all of you is, what did you think when you saw the rabbits?
I thought, yay, I'm super into this. Like, personally, it was my first thing. I have had it a little spoiled for me, though. Apparently this was a web series that he did like 2002 called Rabbits, and I guess voiced by, I'm going to miss it here.
Naomi Watts is one of them.
Yeah. Laura Herring and Scott Coffey.
That's why I said, I wonder who I will be, because apparently that's the last line in the whole of the series. Angela, what did you think when you saw Rabbits?
It's because I didn't know the web series thing.
I didn't either.
I thought it was more of like kind of a play on sitcoms, and which is another way of looking at life and kind of a comparison to how we position things cinematically versus for the TV. And I felt like there was a theme here about watching on all kinds of different levels. Like, how do we watch actors? How do actors watch us? Where are, like, and the repetitiveness of that watching once that medium comes to like the television. And I just felt like the rabbits were one more layer of that. The rabbits are a layer. Yeah. But I didn't have like a tremendous like earth-shaking moment looking at it. I just like, oh, hey, let's throw in the structure of a TV show into this paradigm and see what happens. Because he's also, right, he is also a TV maker. Mm-hmm. So maybe that harkens back to that as well.
Mm-hmm. I was just excited. I was just like, all right, I'm in it. Let's go. Let's go, rabbits.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed to learn that it was that web series, because it makes the uniqueness, the exclusivity of such a jarring and to me very affecting like scene or image. Like, it diluted it a little bit, but not much.
No, but actually it makes it more meaningful, because then it extends that universe to that web series.
Sure.
Which creates more meaning. Now you can watch the web series and see how that impacts your experience of the film.
That was my take on it. I'd seen the web series, like I've seen Rabbits. So when I saw it in the movie, I was like, okay, we're going meta. Strap greatest in.
Yeah, greatest hits.
It's going to be like On Cinema at the Cinema, yeah. I honestly don't know how to talk about this movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, from the very beginning, I was, not the very beginning, but once, because you've got, I forget the actress's name, but she played Laura's mom on
Grace
Twin Peaks. Yeah, like stumbling into Laura Dern's mansion and, you know, and all that stuff. Like, it, and then once Justin Thoreau is brought in. Because I'd briefly forgotten that he was like a director in Mulholland Drive. Mm-hmm. I was very much like, but also the characters are dressed the same and kind of look the same. And I was like, what is the relationship between this movie and Mulholland Drive? And I think it's a bad thing for me to do to compare those two movies because, Angela, I'm with you. I think Mulholland Drive is a weird, strange, surreal dream, but I think it's pretty intelligible. Like, I feel like I, like oh, I get what this movie's through line is, and I get its whole thing. And I think Inland Empire is purposefully not so much that. Mm-hmm. But also, clearly, they seem related, these movies. Yeah, more than just they're made by the same person, but I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that Laura's mom shows up, she starts talking in ways and about a thing where you start to get what maybe the plot is going to be about. Yeah. And she talks about like having unpaid bills, and then she makes hints of like what I can't remember what day it is. Is this today or the day before yesterday or is this tomorrow? And she talks about how like, you, Laura, are going to be like, sitting over there on the other end of the, couch or whatever and all that stuff. And so you sort of get this idea that there are like overlapping timelines of sorts and stuff just from, kind of what she's talking about.
But also this is a continuation of a cinematic theme that I keep seeing in movies that we watch whereby like awkward social situation that communication could clearly solve. Like, weird neighbor comes by. She's like,
get out of here,
Laura.
Get out of here, this is creepy weird as fuck. Old lady.
Go away. Oh, nice to meet you. Oh, I'll be sure to bring by a fruit basket. So when that doesn't happen, right? That doesn't happen at all. Like, it's a suggestion that none of society's rules or expectations, even cinematically, are going to come into play in this movie and to just drop them. That's how I took that whole scene. Mm-hmm.
What else, Corey?
I don't know. Like, I'm trying to remember. So, like, this is a hard movie to talk about. I'm trying to just like think of like what happens next. I guess she does end up getting the part, which is the
and the butler clasps his hand and stands up on one leg. Yeah. I was like, we are watching a David Lynch ass movie.
I love it. I think like one of my favorite parts, and like watching this again on my second watch through, I realized that like the first third of the movie is like my favorite part. Because I'm not entirely sure that it holds up on all of its themes and stuff towards the end. It just gets even, kind of crazier. But like the whole TV show thing, where they go on like the talk show, that's just so strange and over the top.
I honestly forgot about that. The talk show was really fun. I loved that scene because
I loved about it, because this is a film that is a critique on the industry of filmmaking and the act of filmmaking. And what the experience I got from watching all of this is that there is a perspective of what we have of what we think it looks like to make a movie, right? And we think it's all of this glamour and the talk shows and the gossip. But actually, what filmmaking is the really boring, mundane stuff of the director arguing with the lighting guy. And I just found that those parts seemed less, like, more cohesive to me as a critique of filmmaking or a dissection of it.
Wait, but even before that, because there's the Jeremy Irons part of this, and this is maybe a criticism I have, is maybe early on, because as Corey said, he didn't have a script for this, and as like I read in like the Wikipedia page, for whatever that's worth, like that this went on without a script. Like, he would write the script as it went, and so but like it seemed like maybe towards the beginning of production, he was trying to jam some coherence into it that maybe like what I'm specifically referring to is the fact that the reveal that this movie is not an original one, but is a remake of a Polish one that was cursed.
On a cursed film, yeah.
Yeah, which seems like, and Corey, since you watched it twice, like it seemed like that line of thematic intrigue didn't necessarily go anywhere, and it seems like that wasn't like exactly needed. I don't know.
Oh, no, I thought that's
pretty
much
the curse.
The
reason
is the
thing that happens.
Yeah. So here's what I think the plot is. So she gets this part. She gets on this movie. It's a cursed movie. It's called 4/7 or whatever. where the both of the characters had died on. And then also kind of at the beginning, there's lots of hints that they're going to start having an affair, you know, Devin. Yeah. And
it's a lot of infidelity stuff in this. Yeah. In this movie.
Mononormative culture. Come on, people.
Muchos anxiety.
Yeah. Ugh. And so there's lots of anxiety about that. And so you have the husband who's this like looming sort of threat. Yeah. Throughout
very
the
scary man.
So boring.
But she gets this curse script, and once they sit down and start doing the run through dialogue or whatever, that's when everything starts to break. That's when they hear like, "Oh, someone's on the set. I'm gonna go look and see what's going on the set." And they go look and they can't find it. And then we come back around that later to that it's a different version of Laura.
It's Laura Dern from weeks ago.
Set. But also there are all these different scenes peppered throughout where Laura and I'm sorry, I just called out the character. Nikki and Devin are in scenes together, like acting or whatever. And we're not entirely sure if what we're seeing is playing out or if it's the acting. Usually you can tell with like the Southern accents and all that stuff. And so they do that a couple of times where it's like, oh, that's them being in character or whatever. Mm. There's this one great scene that like flew by me the first time, but it's Laura. Like they're practicing this scene and she's talking about it like, and she's doing the scene in her Southern accent. And then all of a sudden she just kind of breaks. She's like, "That's funny. That just sounds like our script." She's like talking in the Southern accent. She forgets that she's acting, but she's still so much in the character. And it just like shows how then I think so much of the movie, the last 2/3 of the movie is really her wrestling with like getting sucked into this part. Like all of the stuff where she's like beaten up, like in the face, and she's in that, like she has to climb that tower and she's talking to the guy across the desk.
Yeah,
she's talking in a Southern accent the whole time. And I'm pretty sure that's her just being completely absorbed into the character of this. A lot of her running around, into the,
but what I'm saying is I don't need
door. And when she opens the 47 door, it goes into the bunny house and stuff like
the
that.
Rabbits. So yeah. But what I'm saying is like that all of these complications sort of exist thematically, even without it being a cursed film. Like, I don't know. That maybe it's like I think I lost the thread that this was a cursed film and all of this was just the themes of the movie at large. But yeah,
it's true. It didn't have to be a cursed film. I mean, it could have just been. Yeah,
well, this film feels cursed though, doesn't it? Like
it's the camcorder. It's the visuals. Like,
I kept trying to adjust the quality of my playback because I was like, this thing looks terrible. I was like, oh, we shot it on video in like 2006 or whatever. Yeah. I was like, of course.
Yeah.
But this movie, for most of this movie, like a lot of David Lynch's movies, like this movie, like mood wise exists in that place in a horror film where the character goes to investigate a noise. And then in that moment between them going, "Oh, it's nothing," and the jump scare that you're waiting for, that's what this movie feels like for 3 hours. And it like demands this like intense watch because it's so like obtuse and very surreal. It demands that you like sit, lean in and watch it. And then it has this incredible like dread all about it. It has occasional jump scares. Like it's a movie that like watches you back, let's say. It feels like a cursed movie. And I think David Lynch is maybe demonstrating some self-awareness by being like, doesn't this movie feel weird?
So I did what Peter wanted to do, but what was funny is I was intent on sitting and watching all three hours, and I sat with my partner, and we got through 35 minutes and decided this was not how we wanted to spend our date. So,
not a date movie.
No.
It is if you're married to Frida.
That's true.
Yes, yeah. And I forget where I was going with this, but the whole...
You broke it up in chunks.
I broke it up in chunks. And so I was able to just sort of absorb that first half an hour. Mm. What were you saying, Wizard, about that before I interrupted you?
It's a movie that demands intense watching.
That's what it is.
It's super creepy.
I came to a conscious choice because I was taking so many breaks. Where I was like, I felt my body just tense and I'm just waiting for that payoff, that like horror jump scare. And I was just like, wait a minute. This jump scare ain't happening. I'm going to just calm the fuck down. And I created sort of a distance between what I was watching. I stopped watching
it. You put on your rabbit head.
I put on my rabbit head entirely. And that made it, at least for the next hour, so much more enjoyable. Like, I was, and that's when I started writing like 500 words on weird shit about David Lynch in this movie, about the camera and the dissolution of self, and all this crazy stuff, and like having a stake in the story because you're so uncomfortable. Anyway,
sounds about right. That describes how I feel about this movie.
Yeah, and I don't think it is a dream, you know. And I think that if you're going to look for, you know, reasons for everything that's in a dream, you're probably going to miss the larger picture of why was the dream, you know, sort of even happening.
Corey,
in the first place.
No, I think there's still something.
But this
beautiful
is what I tell you every other movie.
I know
we do have this conversation a lot.
Like totally. This is the Scream. This is that is my whole thing with the Scream. Of you're saying, why doesn't he just tell that force of nature to get out of their house?
Yeah. Like, no, I am. I'm hypocritical and self-aware, so don't worry.
I love you deeply. I just thank you for letting me do that out.
And that's why I asked Frida, like, would you still like this if this was not a David Lynch movie? And, you know, for me,
that's an impossible question.
Yeah, it's so a David Lynch movie.
I know, but like, and that's what made it fun for me. And that's why I'm like more forgiving on it than I guess I am with other people and stuff, because I have such a connection and I see all the little David Lynch touches and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, there's something comforting about David Lynch.
I really love the scene. Maybe for me the best scene in the movie is the scene after she finishes vomiting blood, where she's like lying on the ground and the woman is like, you dying, and like lights the lighter and holds it in front of her face
with Terry Crews
cameo. The only thing that makes that scene not great is a very distracting Terry Crews in the background.
Yeah,
it's not his fault. But I'm like, what is this? This is how he landed Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He's like, I worked with Mr. David Lynch.
Wait, so that was your favorite scene?
That was definitely one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I don't know if it's my favorite. How could I pick out of such an incredible? I loved the weird Polish barbecue. All of those things were like
that dude spilled so much ketchup. So much on ketchup. His shirt. I don't know situation where he had half of the bottle.
This weekend driving back from LA, I was eating French fries in the car driving, and I got ketchup on one of my favorite shirts this weekend. So I'm just saying it's a sign.
It's possible.
I think that, you know, watching this movie too, it's almost like, it feels like a David Lynch would hate this, but it feels like a bar movie where it's like, you have something on in the background and like, it has all these interesting like visuals and like, you know, almost like every, you know, frame of painting or whatever is the saying goes, because it's hard to talk about this movie because you're not really there to talk about it. You're there to like get the visuals that he's always like kind of putting at you.
No,
stuff.
But I think the sound is excellent.
Sound is excellent. You're there to feel it.
The music and the sound design was really noticeably amazing to me.
That one last scene with Terry Crews, I have to say I was kind of annoyed that they went all the way to like that vaginal injury to the intestines. I'm can we just stop using violence against women to create tension.
This movie is actually something I want to talk about.
And I know, and I feel like,
was this movie written by a man?
It was, well, no, but also
specifically David Lynch, because so many of his stories are like women in peril. Even like the tagline for this movie is like Inland Empire, a woman in trouble. But like so many of his movies are about bad things happening to like women. And so I don't know, something interesting to talk about.
Well, but I was like, I deeply rolled my eyes at the when Laura Dern switches characters or whatever, and it's just the room of women who I guess are sex workers.
I think so. Yeah.
And then one of them like just takes off her top to show the other women her breasts.
That was sweet. They're all like, oh, they're nice. They look great.
It's just some
sisters.
I don't know. I just felt like those sex workers don't look like any sex workers I've known. But like it was just weird. I don't know. It's David Lynch's world and we're all just living in it.
Sure. But I agree. I mean, I agree with you, Corey. Like I think the movie holds, because I deeply love Blue Velvet. I think that movie has just like scarred. I've never didn't like it, but I just, the more I've watched it and the more I think about it, I think it's an incredibly good movie. But I think that movie rests a lot of its tension and drama on that very arresting shot of I forget her name.
Isabella
naked.
Rossellini.
Yeah. Isabella Rossellini naked and shaking, uh-huh. You know, and I think there's a lot to wonder about how much he relies on that picture or on that presence of violence or threat against women.
Mm. Yeah. I think he makes interesting female characters, and, you know, he certainly, you know, has them in like big leading roles and all that stuff. So, I mean, I think that's, you know,
sure,
that stuff's good. But yeah, a lot of his plots seem to be about, you know, just bad things happening to women. I mean, that's the whole plot of Twin Peaks.
I feel like on some level,
and Mulholland Drive.
There's a lot of attempts to make a feminist film here, but I don't have the brain power to go into all of them. But like this notion of like the sex worker chorus, of, you know, women kind of all interacting with each other. In feminist cinema, there's a leaning towards showing multitudes as representing the many instead of a main protagonist. And so injecting that in there kind of made me go, is there something, is he trying to say something about being, what is it to be a successful actress in Hollywood? Like, you don't just get to be an actress. You have to also, you know, have your love life and sex life scrutinized on these TV shows. I don't know.
I mean, I agree with you but also I think that also makes Inland Empire's comparison to Mulholland Drive also stand out.
Ding, ding.
I think Mulholland Drive, I'm not sure how recently you all have seen it, but I was able to see it in a theater last year.
Oh, nice.
Had a great time rewatching it on a big old screen. And what struck me about that movie, especially rewatching this one, is how much there is about female companionship and support, or at least an attempt to have that be like a guiding principle and story driving narrative around it. Yeah.
I guess one of the things I also think about David Lynch too is he for some reason I just think of him as very much a boomer director. Like, I mean, because he is a boomer or whatever, but I just feel like so much of his aesthetics and stuff come from just growing up in the 50s and 60s and stuff. And so when they were all like dancing to "Come On Baby, Do the Locomotion," I was just
God,
this
so
is
great.
Just such a interesting.
I loved it. Loved it so much.
So great.
Yeah.
What did did I write about something in that section? Let's see.
Wizard, you kind of hit on a lot of my feelings about this movie. Because this was also another one of these, like The Scream. Mm. Boy, never going to stop talking about The Scream.
The new Vagabond.
The new Vagabond.
The Scream is the new Vagabond, everybody.
But this movie was terrifying to me. Inland Empire was horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It was
yeah.
like deeply
yeah.
emotionally troubling to me, but also in the way that I love. Mm-hmm. Like those rabbits, that's fucking scary.
They're very scary.
In the way that I love. And I think a lot of this movie, it's exactly, Wizard, you should fucking copyright what you just said about like the waiting for the jump scare that never comes.
And then it comes.
It does come.
but I mean, I feel like this movie is that wait in a lot of ways, as Wizard says. I absolutely agree with that. And there's just like this foreboding, like very oppressive sense of dread, you know, and it creeps in. And I'll say that's probably a big reason why I was so captivated to keep watching it, because I'm like, I'm just going to live in this muck.
This is a weird space.
I would say, though, that Mulholland Drive is better. I think Mulholland Drive is a much better movie, though.
I think that's probably pretty universally.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I absolutely agree. Like, Mulholland Drive is a masterpiece. I'm not at a point where I'm going to call Inland Empire.
And in fact, actually, the comparison in itself is also a commentary on film and what it takes to make a film, knowing that he didn't have his regular editor, he didn't have his regular composer. Right. And he's using these substandard things. He is maybe somehow commenting on just what it takes to make a film to the standard that we are accustomed to.
I'm going to take that. So my spin on it, mm-hmm. Angela, as I was watching this, was I talk a lot in my own personal life, about the movie Us, about Jordan Peele's Us.
Mm-hmm.
Which I fucking dearly love, despite the fact that it is a deeply flawed movie. Like, there's something so harebrained and out of the like fucking, there's something so personally like explorative about that movie because he had his success with he had a success with Get Out, and so it's like a free pass, and he took that free pass and he was like, cool, I'm gonna make the fucking movie I want to make. And he made this deeply weird, mm-hmm. like deeply specific, like very heavily creative movie. And I thought a lot about Us while watching Inland Empire, because as you're saying, Angela, he didn't have any of those people, and I think that was very purposeful, yeah. so he could have complete control over the movie he wanted to make. Mm-hmm. And so it, like, it just is, I don't think Us is a better movie than Get Out. Mm. I don't think this is a better movie than a lot of other David Lynch's films, but I respect and love the hell out of Inland Empire because it feels like that pure shit. Because it does feel like that like saturated pure shit.
Yeah,
uncut
but I
Lynch.
Uncut Lynch, but it also talks to the sacrifices you have to make when you decide to do it all yourself. Like, you might not end up with a better product. You will end up with a pure product to yourself. But will that product actually connect more deeply with other people? I don't know, because I feel like everything that was lacking on a traditional cinema level in terms of quality, right? The quality of the film stock that they used with the video camera, the ratio. Sorry, yeah, it's not film stock.
No. I'm laughing at the movie, not at you. Yeah.
And then just the ratios in the cinematography mm-hmm. of the close up mm-hmm. to the camera were off, and they were unsettling, and that was purposeful, yeah. and it disrupted your experience of the film, like your ability to become enmeshed in the film, right? In my opinion, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, no, I mean, I agree with you. Oh, sorry. I'm going
so let me
go ahead.
Let me finish my point.
Yeah, sorry.
And to the point where you have to watch it at a remove. You don't get to have the magic, the movie magic of this almost happening to you, because it's not. It's happening to the main to Laura Dern's character. I am enamored of all the cinematic things that he did or did not do to make you even more uncomfortable in this movie.
So, I mean, like, the magic for me, just as I think with my comparison about Us, is that it feels like a uniquely special present to get this amount of pure David Lynch, right? And I feel like, I agree with you that this is a less... I didn't connect with this movie as much as I did with other ones, mm-hmm. but it's still, like, kind of a fascinating view into, like, what if mm-hmm. an artist... with the mind of David Lynch, like, just gave you his pure, unfiltered thoughts. You know, I'm a professional editor. Like, my whole job is to tell people that, hey, you need somebody else to run through your shit, because the vast majority of time, somebody else needs to run through your shit.
So, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. That's it to say. But I think it is, like, uniquely special to, like, get a pure glimpse of what I think is like a brilliant artist's mind in this way, whether or not it's like a better overall product or not.
But sorry. And to that, I was actually like thinking as I was watching this, you know, more than anything else that David Lynch has made, there's more of a direct line here between this movie and Twin Peaks season 3. Which has anybody
which
watched?
I still haven't watched, actually.
No.
I'm saving it. I don't know what I'm saving it for, but I'm so excited. But it seems like I want to.
Well, it's very much like Inland Empire. And so it's you know, interesting to think that he hasn't made another film since Inland Empire, but it's very much Twin Peaks season 3, where mm-hmm. so much
which
of that
2017.
Is just. But it's like so much like just dreamy, weird, like strange, you know, it's the same kind of stuff here. I found myself getting really bored with Twin Peaks season 3 because I really liked the juxtaposition of the David Lynchian weirdness with the sort of traditional like television show soap opera type stuff that was happening in Twin Peaks, where it's like you have this, you know, Mark Frost, who's very much a, you know, TV writer, veteran person, you know, where David Lynch, you know, takes this, you know, soap opera and makes it, you know, extra strange. Whereas season 3 very much feels like unhinged David Lynch going off like all on his own and stuff. And I actually just looked it up. I assumed that he just did it on his own, but I looked it up and I guess no, Mark Frost did help him write season 3, which actually surprises me because it feels like just pure unadulterated unhinged David Lynch.
So one of the things that was big in Inland Empire, which I've talked about, I think I talk about a lot, and I should curb myself after this discussion, but I really, really love the idea of duality. Speaking of us, you know, but I really love the themes of doppelgangers, of doubles, of different versions of yourself, and how you know, the existential sort of quandaries and ruminations you can compile out of narratives with those structures. Mm-hmm. And I like, and this walks that line of, yeah, I mean, he's done this forever. You know, I mean, like, he did this with basically every, well, not everything he's done, but I mean, even you look at Twin Peaks, and even the, you know, the Laura Palmer, as people saw her, and the Laura Palmer in, you know, secret life, mm-hmm. is, you know, a reflection of that as well. And so, but I'm still not tired of it, and I still very much get wrapped up in this idea, because I think it's loaded with an actor's presentation of it, of these are the parts that I'm playing, but also this is the life that I'm playing within that part.
Is this a meditation on method acting? Where you go so far into it that you just completely lose yourself in the character?
I was just so excited at that Terry Crews scene, because it's just the Terry Crews scene now, when it pulls back and there's the camera and mm-hmm. the,
oh,
I was just
God.
So
yes.
like yeah. it's great.
Camera
it's
as
good.
Menace. This is another film that we've
oh,
seen
yeah.
camera
with
menace,
the camera
yeah.
as menace, like Jane B had that as well. And I feel mm-hmm. like there's something mm-hmm. else. Also, there was an element to that in The Hour of the Wolf, was there not? Or maybe not.
No, there was something else, though. I remember the camera as a menace. We've talked about this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But boy, those close-ups in this fucking movie. Can't get any closer.
Yeah, no,
count
and
the
pores. The like, low, what is it, lens width and stuff.
It.
Everybody's like just a little like warped and stuff. Fish-eyed a little and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, and just like the stiff, weird acting that, like, there are so many scenes where it just feels like an amateur, you know, filmmaker making something rather than someone who's been doing this for decades and decades and decades.
I felt that stiff acting, though, played into the story. Like, it's still meant to keep you from getting really engaged in the film. Like,
mm-hmm. yeah.
It's never letting you forget that this is a film.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not mm-hmm. complaining about it. It's just,
oh, I know.
It's very noticeable.
It's disconcerting, though. It feels uncomfortable. You're like, can you know, it just feels weird.
Yeah. I don't know. Anything to say about, like, the music and the sound and all that stuff in it? I mean, I think it's funny knowing that he made all the music in this, and so much of it is just very directly David Lynch movie music. You
that
know?
Song he sings yeah. about love is fucking amazing.
But it was a surprise to me. Like, it sounded even beyond. I didn't know he did the music or the sound until I was looking up stuff about it mm-hmm. afterwards. Because I was expecting Badalamenti, and while maybe the like melodies weren't there, the like soundscapes, mm-hmm. I guess is how I would call it, rather than like songs, I felt were like much richer and much more like experimental and had a lot of like fascinating layers. I loved the sound of this movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, does anybody have anything else to say, or should we?
Oh, can we talk a minute about Mary Steenburgen? Like, she just
oh, yeah.
magically
oh, my
appears.
God, I forgot she was in that.
In the film, yeah. and I'm like, Mary Steenburgen, David Lynch, what did she ever do to you? Like, she just magically, she's one of my favorite actresses. I have had a crush on her for years, like, going
she's
back
great.
To Back to the Future 3. She is married to Ted Danson. And when she just appeared, I'm just like, no, don't do anything bad to her. But she kind of appears and then never comes back. And I wanted more Mary Steenburgen.
I mean, I think if David Lynch calls and asks you to do a cameo role in one of his movies, you got to say yes.
Well, like, yeah, like William H. Macy
yeah.
as,
oh,
the,
as
like,
the
presenter
weird announcer
for that
guy,
one
yeah.
sentence. Yeah. yeah. And even Naomi Watts as the voice of one of the rabbits mm-hmm. with like four lines in this movie.
Are we like, are we any closer to deciphering or like truly expressing how we feel about watching this movie? Like,
wait, I've got a bigger question that maybe Corey can answer, or at least a question for me that I'm interested in. Corey, what the fuck's going on with the Polishness of it? Like, I think
the Poland of it all.
Well, as I am a Polish person, so. So, but it's but what, like, did you, I guess I didn't understand why or what the relation was, and like, I was surprised to find out looking at synopses that some parts of it were taking place in like 1930s Poland. And I'm like, I don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's when the original film production was happening.
I should watch the original
4/7 or whatever film that, you know, the people died and all that stuff. So that's all the sort of flashback type stuff is happening around that stuff. Poland? I have no idea.
Well, I mean, like, Poland 1930s, you know, is annexation times, baby. Mm-hmm. And it's not an insignificant time in Western world history.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, what is it that we know about Poland, or what do we as Americans experience as Poland? Because I feel like Lynch is always sort of presenting things from an American point of view. It's not a European point of view. And the Polish stuff is just out of nowhere, which makes it seem like it is actually important. So as far as I'm concerned, when I grew up, people would say that I wasn't Italian, that because I didn't look Italian, and instead I must be Polish, which on the East Coast is a special way of saying you're stupid. I don't know. There's a weird relationship with America and Poland, and like negative associations necessarily with it. And it, I just find it interesting that he incorporated that into the movie.
Yes.
It was weird.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I was trying to find what the significance was beyond it being unexpected. I wouldn't expect to find this to be a Polish-American joint production of a David Lynch movie. Mm-hmm.
Is it a funding thing? Did this film only get funded because...
That's a great question.
But then you don't have to make it so much, or maybe you do have to make it so much a part of your story. Maybe you're trying to get funding from a Polish investor, and you're like, I'm going to roll that in somehow. Because let's see, Laura Dern's husband is Polish. His family is disappointed that she doesn't speak Polish.
I do think I read that he financed a lot of this himself.
Mm-hmm.
Majority of this himself.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the... What are we doing? What are we doing with the Poland stuff?
I loved the ending. I loved because I do think that a lot of these, just as I thought with Mulholland Drive, I think a lot of the sort of like meaning or themes or whatever are pretty surface in like in a very broad way that people tend to like look too deep in and I think they're just kind of like very like. The scenes of Laura Dern sort of looking through a burnt hole mm-hmm. of layers, like she's looking through layers mm-hmm. of, you know, it's just mm-hmm. like, these are all just pretty sort of apparent sort of things that, and I think there's a lot of like,
put a pin in that
light. What?
Put a pin in that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, I think there's just a lot of like light and shadow usages. I mean, even the rabbits holding up candles and whatever like that mm-hmm. of like shining lights and like, you know, when she's shooting at the phantom or whatever, like it's blasting a light in his face or, you know, in this person's face. Like there's just a lot of like sort of trying to find truth throughout all of this darkness. And I think the last scene is particularly notable mm-hmm. because so many of those characters that are just kind of offhandedly mentioned throughout the movie, like the woman with one leg, like the woman who owns the monkey that throws shit around,
mm-hmm.
like instead of being these sort of ephemeral characters in these like, you know, throw off dialogue parts, like they're real, they have substance, they're dancing along with this choir next to the lumberjack who's sawing wood.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, the most apparent sort of symbolistic thing or whatever is to have someone actually sawing logs, like yes, this is all a dream. I mean that's how I read
that's
it.
Cute. Like, that's cute. Oh, I like that. Yeah. That is interesting. It was a great ending. I loved how
Nina Simone song. That's
love a movie where it ends with everybody dancing. That's great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's also right. like, you know, the scene is happening and it's fun and all that stuff. But it's also, you know, then sort of the chorus is joined by some African American women dancers and stuff. And it's just like, yeah, David Lynch doesn't really do people of color. Like he just doesn't. And even when he does, it's kind of like at the very end afterthought. And it's like, oh, gosh, David.
Oh, before that last scene, actually, I wrote down a note to myself because I think it's very funny of like sort of the denouement before, like, the actual, you know, dancing scene, where, like, Laura Dern's back in her mansion or whatever. Like, there's some mute song playing, and the lyrics of the song were, "Something is happening." And I was like, that's just the, every line of this script is, something happens.
Yeah.
A woman is in trouble. Something is happening.
And yeah, and I think that the last part of it is, you know, because even the lumberjack reminded me of like Twin Peaks and just the, everyone like lip syncing and stuff. Like David Lynch just loves people lip syncing and stuff. And so it's almost putting like a cap on like, yeah, this is just what it's like to inhabit the inside of my brain for a while. Like this is the, here's your greatest hits for, you know, David Lynch.
Yeah.
Yep.
I have a fun fact about the Rabbit miniseries, but should I wait
for that? Yeah, no, go for it.
On, or should I?
Let's hear it.
I was doing my diving. I did maybe more than I usually do for these movies, trying to find any hints or bits of parts of these production. Apparently, there was a study done. I should find out when that study was. The study was done probably about a decade ago to test the effects of acetaminophen on, or just Tylenol. On people experiencing existential crises or existential dread. And so test subjects were either shown a control, like, which was The Simpsons, or was shown David Lynch's Rabbit web series. to test the resilience of acetaminophen to help counteract the effects of existential uneasiness or dread.
That's solid.
Well, that tracks. Interesting. Well,
it did work. It did. One study. It was conclusive that Tylenol was helpful in combating the effects of existential dread.
Acetaminophen. Don't pop your Tylenol. Tylenol, if it was introduced to the market today, it would like absolutely not get FDA approval because it has so many side effects. But please don't sue us.
So does David Lynch's Rabbits.
And Inland Empire.
Well, this has been a pretty good discussion. I appreciate it. I would like to move us on to seeing if, I mean, Peter, you're the stalwart, you know, one that holds out that we cannot adjust our ratings or whatever. I don't know.
In the same episode, we can.
Yeah, right. But I'm just saying. Same episode, and then
so
it's
get
set
it
in
right
stone.
The first time,
it's
people.
Yeah, in. Shenanigans, man. No, they will be called.
I think I have a fairly good idea for what I would rank this movie. I mean, I did watch it twice after all. But let's start with Angela. Angela. I'm sorry. And on this episode, on this podcast, we do things a little different. We rate from 1 to 20 as a nod to the D20 in role playing games. Angela. How would you rate Inland Empire?
I'm going to give it a 13.
Whoa.
I'm going on. I mean, as a swan song of cinema from David Lynch, I fully endorse the notion that you should experiment and play and kind of do wacky things. And this crazy mixed up dream has provided a ton of context and or comparison with other films in his oeuvre, and I don't know that other filmmakers have ever had that opportunity or taken it, so he gets some extra points in my book for having the ovaries to do it, and to feature a female actress in the lead role of such a film. So it gets a hearty 13.
Very good. How about you, Wizard? What are you rating Inland Empire?
He's thinking. He's mulling it, audience.
I honestly, sorry, it's almost impossible.
It's exactly. What the fuck do you do with this?
Yeah, I'll give it a 13. Angela's right. Ooh. Like it's good to play. Go, David Lynch, play. I liked parts of your movie. I didn't like other parts of it. And I'm still thinking.
Did we talk
about
enough
it.
About? The parts that you didn't like of it?
I think so. I don't know. Like, okay. I think so. I just like what I didn't like about it was mostly like the middle, like just kind of goes on. And it seems like all of the drama, like has kind of like whatever leaked drama out. Is, it's all leaked out. It's deflated. And then it starts to pick back up again. And like, I'm like, oh shit. Like the back third of the movie is my favorite part of the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, yeah, but I think, you know, it's a weird, it's such a weird movie.
It is
so,
a weird.
It deserves a weird rating, and so I give it a 13.
Lucky 13.
Yeah, very good. Peter, how about you?
Fuck. man, yeah, I do think this conversation helped a lot. Like, I think talking it over, I don't know if it gave me like other things to consider, but at least like I found myself like wanting to defend this movie way more than I didn't. But definitely there were times watching it, I was like, what is this? Is this an 8? Is this a 6? What the fuck is this fucking movie? Shit. And I'm still not sure. Like, it's still between a 16 and a 17 for me.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, I will like, you put this on right now, I'll watch it again in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Like, this was like, I don't think it's the best of David Lynch's movies, but I think it's like a particularly unique, and like I said, I think it's like a very unique present that we are given as a, like, to be able to like look at that pure, pure shit. And I think I will think about this movie for a long
time. Here, let me help you, if you don't mind. Movie reminds me of Jane B by Agnes V, because it is in a way playful. And yes. So I would put them in similar categories, though it's still very hard to compare. Once I think of it in that way, I need to look and see how I rated.
You gave it a 16. I pulled up the spreadsheet. Listeners,
so thank you,
listeners,
Peter.
You'll be able to, they're really good. Listeners, you will be able to get the spreadsheet on the show notes. It's right there. You gave it a 16. I gave Jane B versus by Agnes V and 18.
Oh.
I'm gonna give this a 7. You gave it 12.
Yeah, okay. You really didn't like it, Corey.
No,
yeah.
12. That's above 10. I liked it.
That's a big Corey number. Yeah.
That is actually.
You can call Corey the middle man, because he's all mids on these 20s. I think I'm maybe gonna think that's a little high, because I think in my heart of hearts this is a 16.5. But I think I'm gonna lean towards 17 on Inland Empire. Right. This was a very unique experience, and I would watch it again in a heartbeat, and I will continue to think about it.
I would.
Corey, what about you? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I would interject that this movie kind of reminds me of like Brand New Music that you've heard for like the first time. Like, for me, Portishead, where it sounds discordant and weird and makes you uncomfortable, but like once you hear it two or three times, it becomes crystal clear. So I might watch it a second time.
I'd definitely watch it again. I would take another crack at Inland Empire. Like, it's special.
Yeah.
Angela,
yeah.
It's actually funny that you say that. When I was in the shower earlier, I was thinking of, I was reflecting on Inland Empire, and I was actually thinking that it felt like going to see a concert for a band that I really like. So a band who I know their entire discography, but they've come out with a new album. And so you're watching it, and you're watching, and you know a lot of the hits, but then they're also throwing in some new stuff too. And that's very much how this felt. It's like, I'm very familiar with David Lynch. I got to see all the David Lynchy stuff in it and stuff too, but they're also throwing in some of the new stuff as well. Peter, if you gave this a 13, I was going to go ahead and give it a 13 too. So we'd all would have given it a 13.
I'm 17. Yeah.
But the number that it just I had in my mind after I got finished watching it for the second time was a 14. So yeah.
What the fuck? Did I really like it more than you all?
I think so.
That's weird. I didn't expect that to happen. Okay.
Very good.
Watched it twice.
So that's another round of Crit Club down, and we're actually running sort of on time. I was wondering if this was going to stretch on and on, because it's such a long movie.
Perhaps it already has.
Yeah, listeners, what did you think of Inland Empire? Please drop us a line. You can email us at critclubpodcast@gmail.com, and you can also find us on Threads at Crit Club Podcast.
And Instagram.
Same yes, thing. Find us there too. And you can also let us know what you think of next week's movie, which I believe is a Peter pick. Peter, what are we going to be watching next week?
I'm just looking through my past scores to make sure that this isn't incongruous. One second.
Okay, wait, because listeners, we have a rule where you can change your role up until the end of the show.
And I will, however, say that we are all constantly changing and evolving as people. And so what we would have given something as a 16 or a 17, like 2 years ago, it could be different, or it could be a 16 or a 17 now because you've changed as a person.
True.
That was one of my, we have our 51st episode extravaganza, which you can listen to. And one of my favorite, like that whole episode was so fun and I loved all of it. But one of my favorite parts was like looking back at different things and how we would potentially rate them differently. But as I'm like looking back on my scores, like, yeah, this, I think 17 feels good with this. Like I think I'm fine with 17. I gave the shout a 16, and I do think this is one better than
exactly
the shout.
One better.
We're now going to be rating so much better than the Peter's shout. Ratings according to how good, much better or worse they are to the shout at this point.
Well, I gave Vagabond an 18, and if I in our 51st episode, I did say I should have given that a 19. That was one of my few considerations. Is Vagabond should have been a 19. Yes, it is my pick. And now for something completely different. I was, because I had no idea when I opened up the Criterion channel of like what even I was going to suggest. And there's part of me that's like, was I too swayed by the very first thing I saw? Because the very first thing I saw was the Criterion Channel has now a collection called Women Westerns.
Oh, yeah.
and I was like, oh, I like Westerns.
Same.
Do you?
And it didn't take me personally. Like I've absolutely gained such a huge fondness over them over the past, like, I want to say 10, 15 years. And I think in the past, like, there's this time period of 50s and 60s Westerns, maybe 50s through 70s Westerns that I feel like I want to know more of. Mm-hmm. And so I found maybe the best, one of the best titles, at least that I've picked within this run of the Crit Club. Listeners, we're going to be watching 1954's American Western film called Johnny Guitar.
Yeah. Starring
directed by Nicholas Ray and starring Joan Crawford.
I'm so excited.
So exciting.
Yeah, I why did I even pick this movie?
Because Joan Crawford.
Because Joan Crawford, because like a Western, because it's in this like true color. I'm such a sucker for like Technicolor and all sorts of like color technology that was being done to make movies in this like weird era. I also think there's a lot of like fascinating legacy work about Johnny Guitar, including about how Joan Crawford like owned the rights to this book and demanded that her character be made the star of the movie to the screenwriter. And also about reading on Wikipedia here about how lasting an impression it gave European audiences, including Jean-Luc Godard and Francis Truffaut, about like this like got a huge, like Pedro Almodovar paid homage to this film. I don't know. Johnny, but it's called fucking Johnny Guitar. Mm-hmm. Let me watch any movie called Johnny Guitar. So
you and I are in some ways very different people.
established over the decades. no, I mean, like, I'm not going to say it's going to be good. And as I talked about in a 51st episode, I always worry that I'm too experimental with my picks because I don't know if this is fucking going to be good or not. Like, it sounds fun and interesting. And I know nothing about this movie or the sort of like, it's probably going to be pretty, whatever. We're gonna watch Johnny Guitar.
Who can say?
All right.
Who can
say? I'm excited.
I have not seen very many Westerns. I've only seen a few, and the ones that I've seen, I have liked. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know where I'm going next pick.
More Westerns.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, there you have it. Next week, it's Johnny Guitar. Thanks.
Corey, you're telling me that's not enough to get you interested in a movie that is called Johnny Guitar.
Sure. No, to be true, just the Joan Crawford is the thing that I'm interested in. So I think this is going to be another one that I'm going to have to watch with Frida. She is a... We recently came up with a list of like top 10 favorite movies, and it's no surprise that Mommy Dearest is one of her top favorite movies of all time. It's in there all the time.
I've never seen that.
I'm excited to see some Joan Crawford.
Unhinged.
Yeah. All right. Well, that about does it for the main part of the podcast this week. But we do have one other section where we talk about other things, other pieces of media that we have been consuming lately called What Else You Watching? So, Angela, what else you've been watching? You look a little quizzical. Maybe not a whole lot.
I haven't been watching much. I mean, I'm still on the Blue Eye Samurai.
Been half a week watching Inland Empire.
Yeah, I've been too busy watching Inland Empire. That took. I mean, it took me over like 4 days to get that completed because I was determined to get through a whole movie and not drop the ball. So I've been watching Blue Eye Samurai, which just keeps paying off. That story is dynamic and beautiful and complicated and heartbreaking. Highly recommend it.
I started watching it. It's fun.
You like it?
I like it.
Oh, it's good to hear. Thank you. Oh, someone heard it.
It's got graphic samurai violence. It's got a good heart. I'm having a good time.
Oh, yeah. I also picked up the new Nation of Language album. I forget what it's called, but the first song on it breaks my heart every time I listen to it. And I just highly, highly recommend that album. They've been around for a while, but they're a Brooklyn band, sort of like synth poppy. And yeah, if you listen to that album, it's really good.
Very good. How about you, Wizard? What else have you been watching?
Oh, man, I had a busy week. I got onto a lot of stuff. I had a great time watching Netflix's Fall of the House of Usher. That landed
It's really good,
me.
Right?
Really landed
It's not
with
bad.
Me. I loved all the Poe references. I'm a big Edgar Allan Poe fan. I loved all the Poe references. They found a million different
decent.
Ways. It's very
I'm
decent.
Glad you liked it.
It's very like serviceable like horror. Mike Flanagan always does
Succession
a solid,
horror.
Yeah, it's
Succession plus horror.
Succession the horror movie.
Really?
Well, yeah,
I'm interested.
Not as
like intricate or as like character driven, perhaps as Succession. But yeah, it was fun. It was like a solid watch. Everybody nails it. Yeah, definitely worth watching if you've got some time to binge a little horror show. It was good stuff. I watched. I was going through some of the other stuff on Criterion, the '90s horror thing that their collection, I guess. I kicked back and watched John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, which I have not seen for a very long time.
I saw that in a theater last year.
Oh
what
my
a
God.
Fucking movie
what
is
a
that?
Movie. It's like, it's like Ugh. Unhinged in a whole
Sam
different
Neil.
Way. A whole different way.
Ugh.
Really, really good horror movie. Lots of like really just like compelling images. Just it's such a fun time. And oh, there was something else. Oh, I watched The Northman, Robert Eggers' The Northman,
which I was
texting you guys about while I was watching it, because that is a movie that I dearly wanted to see in theaters. I was not able to find time to see it in theaters, and so I just never saw it because I was like, well, obviously the only way to see it is in a theater. And then I had some free time and I started watching it and I was like, this is amazing. I had also like Robert Eggers is one of my favorite filmmakers working today. And like the visual presentation of that movie, the just like again the everything about it, the construction of it is really, really appealing, and everyone does a bang up job. And it's also has graphic sword swinging violence. So I was like, this is great. This is a great time. Yeah, and that I think is everything. In the Mouth of Madness, can't recommend enough. Kick back, watch that movie. John Carpenter fucking rules.
Yeah, I've never seen that. I'm gonna have to check that out. But
oh man, it's a ride. Like I know I saw it a long time ago, but I was not prepared for it. I remember it being fun, but it is fun.
It is a fun movie.
Like it is a lot of fun.
It is a carnival haunted house with way more like tentacles.
God. That was a great movie to watch in the theater because it was like everyone was laughing and having a great time because it's like it's fascinating because it's not like a good bad movie where it's not like so bad it's fun because it also has a sense of humor about itself.
It's an unserious movie,
But it also, but it's not a comedy.
But it's not a comedy.
Like it's just Yeah,
it's great. A horror film. Like it's for people who are like, yeah, horror movie, please. I'll take one, please.
Love it.
Interesting. So one of the things that I watch the most is YouTube, and I never talk about YouTube because it seems weird to talk about it, but I will talk about Climate Town, which is a channel on there, and it's made by Raleigh Williams, who is, I don't know, he has some degrees in, you know, climate science and all that stuff, and he does just extremely fun and entertaining stuff about climate change and also just like urban design and all that stuff, but it's very like funny and well done and all that stuff. And like his latest one is about how the city of Chicago has leased their street, all of their streets to I already forgot what the bank was. It's a major bank. It's like, it's not Merrill Lynch, because
Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo.
It might have been Merrill Lynch.
Wells Fargo.
But basically, for 75 years, anytime they want to do any changes to the streets, anytime they want to like change any parking or anything like that, they have to get their approval on it. Anytime they want to have a parade or someone wants to, you know, shut down something for whatever, they have to pay back the bank for lost revenue. You know, they immediately went in there and they charged, you know, increased prices by like 5 times and all that stuff. And it's just been like this poster child of like horrible privatization. And while they were very funny about it, it's also like, it was an extremely terrifying thing, because I was like, I can't imagine this happening. It's basically, I mean, just, it's one of the worst things in like urban development that I've seen, like modern times or whatever. It's just so sinister and dystopian and disgusting. And I don't know how things like this ever, you know, happen or whatever. So Climate Town, I think he also has a podcast. It's a very great channel. And then this one is maybe coming out a little bit out of left field, but South Park, like seasons like 23 through like 26, I've watched like the most recent seasons. I went traveling with Noah, and whenever we go traveling, we just put South Park on or whatever it is, the sort of thing in the house or whatever. And modern South Park is still really good. Like, it's still really good. It's surprisingly, you know, I compare it to like, obviously when it came out, it was, you know, compared to The Simpsons at the time and stuff. And both of these comedy shows are still running probably long past, you know, any time that they should be or whatever. But whereas like Simpsons had this, you know, early time where they were just like concentrated awesomeness, they've sort of like just, you know, stretch themselves out into this like thing where it's barely watchable. I've tried watching modern seasons of Simpsons, and it's just so like so uncomfortable and unfunny. But South Park was never about like concentrated second to second jokes like Simpsons was. It was more about like, what's a funny idea? And because we keep living in a world where new things happen all the time, just having a funny idea for an episode is still very much doable. I don't know. Modern South Park is still pretty good, strangely enough.
I haven't watched it in a long time. But every time I catch an episode, it's like, yeah, okay, this still feels like it has value.
Yeah,
but I never feel compelled to watch. I don't know.
Yeah, there are some episodes in there where it's like, oh, I'm actually glad South Park is still around so that they can talk about this specific issue, because they're doing a really funny take on it.
Like, I guess I always worry: have they not? Lean too far into like libertarian, mm-mm, like modern.
No, it's still very much a make fun of everybody.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Still very much a make fun of everybody type thing. Anyway, I think that'll about do it for this episode.
Can I tell what I watched?
Do we not get to you, Peter?
No, it's okay.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Peter.
No, what else have you been watching? No. Yeah. No, I've been talking a lot this episode. So it's I understand. I'll be very quick. I want to point out two things. I, of course, never stop watching horror movies, despite the fact that it's November. And I watched, I do think we're in, over the past like 5, 6, 7 years, in something of a renaissance, if not the defining period of horror comedies.
Ooh.
I think that there's some like really, really great horror comedies that have come around. And I finally was able to catch, I think it released this year, it's called The Blackening. Which is Tim Story directed it. Oh, I had it up here. But it's a bunch of black actors. It's a black comedy who are trapped in a house where some sort of Saw-like game is happening. It's just incredibly fun. Like, it's just like so damn good. It's just a really great, just overall, just a solid, wonderful time. And I love this movie. I love that it exists. I'm not sure how it exactly performed box office wise, but I really hope that people catch on to it, because I think The Blackening is fucking awesome. I mentioned it last week. I mentioned Alan Wake 2 last week playing that, and it has continued to grow in my estimation. I now, maybe not the top 10, but definitely the top 15 of video games of all I've played.
That's crazy.
I can't talk about this game. Like, also, it's funny to talk about it while doing a David Lynch episode, because it deeply, deeply wants to incorporate Twin Peaks mm-hmm. into itself. I mean, even the Double R Diner, there is a complete, like, you know, it's a one-to-one, you know, you go into the town diner and it is the same layout as that. But this game does things with storytelling that I've just simply never seen another video game do, both in terms of the actual writing of it and in terms of the environmental storytelling, but also in terms of, like, other forms of getting a message across while playing an action game. There's, like, just a thing that happened that I don't even want to come close to spoiling, because I somehow didn't know that this event occurs, and going through it, I was just like, this is brilliant. Like, I think in terms of, like, what video games can do to tell a story, I will think about this game for decades, if I live that long after, as, like, a deepening turning point for considering how stories can be told in this medium. Fucking Alan Wake 2 is incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Awesome. I can't wait to play it at some point in the future.
Yeah. I still think the combat sucks sometimes. And it's still very frustrating. It's still a flawed game, but I don't give a shit. This game is incredible.
Nice. Sorry, thank you. Yeah. On Remedy's, Remedy's the developer, their Wikipedia page, and it looks like they've announced a Control 2 that they're working on.
Yeah.
So that's,
as well as there's, like, a multiplayer Control game. But I mean, it's like, so like, the director of Alan Wake 2 is a man named Sam Lake, mm-hmm. right? Sam Lake, that person, plays a character in the game. This isn't spoiling because it happens in the first, like, 2 minutes. Plays a character in the game as an FBI agent named Alex Casey, which is the name of the writer Alan Wake's fictional detective, voiced by the Max Payne actor, who, like, it is beyond belief. And it is one of those David Lynchian things where, like, it pushes past that level of roll your eyes pretension to get to that other level of, like, all right, this is just fucking incredible. All right, I've been talking a lot today. Sorry.
Nice. I appreciate it. Well, listeners, if you would like to talk a lot at us, then please reach out to us at CritClubPodcast@gmail.com and CritClubPodcast at Threads and Instagram. I think that is about going to do it for us for this episode of Crit Club. Thanks, everyone, for joining me.
Bye, everybody.
Yay. Bye.
Bye.
Watch Inland Empire at least 3 times.
Johnny Guitar.
Johnny Guitar.
Watch Johnny Guitar.